I'm so excited about the Super Bowl, I could almost ask who's playing. Well, what do you know?
Not much, you!
Live from Kansas City, Missouri to Medford, Oregon, it's Michael Feldman's What Do You Know from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI Public Radio International. That's John Tulin on the piano, Jeff Hammond on bass. I'm Sarah Nix. In this hour of What Do You Know, actor Stephen Tobolowsky, all the news that isn't and the What Do You Know quiz. Support for What Do You Know is provided by PRI affiliate stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And now, the man who puts things out of perspective, it's Michael Feldman.
Oh, yeah. There. Who? Oh, yeah, those guys. The Harbaughs. San Francisco Harbaughs and the Baltimore Harbaughs are playing. Not such a big deal. I used to play against my brothers all the time, you know. Alley ball, but still. Arthur used to draw the button hook on his palm. And I just slip around Howard, take it in the breadbasket, bing. So that's my advice for strategy in this game. I suppose Pop Harbaugh will have more to say about that. That's what I say. Button hook around Howard. Okay. The main thing you want to avoid in this Super Bowl is letting Pop get on the headset. Because you got to have like two pairs of headsets at the same time, giving advice to his sons. That could be a disaster, I think, basically. I don't know. I want to watch brothers fighting. I go to Thanksgiving. Or a Civil War movie, something like that, you know. Or, but you can bong a bud every time Phil Simms says brothers, or brother, or some conjugation of the word brother. That could make it enjoyable, or possibly fatal, actually, is the thing. This Super Bowl does make me wish I had given my girls more hands-on football strategy, you know, because they could be coaching teams now. Just go deep and I'll hit you on the street is probably not enough to get them there. In other news, Republicans welcome immigrants with open guns. Oh, yes. There it is. I do that. I don't know why I do that. She says I do that. I know I don't ever do that. It's to stretch something I don't even have, I think. I don't even know what I'm doing. What? Oh, stay out of this. This is my floundering. The NRA's Wayne LaPierre has never heard of a silencer, apparently. Space Monkey returns to day job as president of Iran. President Obama proposes a contraception compromise withdrawal with prejudice. Excuse me. Birth control is just one of those things you hate to compromise on. You know, it's either yes or no, I think. You know, you don't want to compromise. Boy Scouts offer don't ask, don't tell badge. Of course, next for the Boy Scouts, Jews. They're going to let Jews in next. Because I don't know a single Jew who can tie a knot. And I've asked a lot of my Jewish friends. John Kerry approved as Secretary of State without anyone asking why the long face. Thought for sure that would come up. Just, you know, gag or something. Housing prices on the rise. It's up to $40 on Mediterranean Avenue. Baltic is still sluggish. Grandma, what big retina displays you have. What is that doing in there? I don't understand why. I thought that was funny, and I was wrong. Lindsey Vonn rubbing off on Tiger Woods. Well, they say they're going together now, you see, and suddenly he's winning, huh? Coincidence? I don't think so. Yeah, won the Farmers Insurance Open, which means crop protection for life for Tiger Woods. Let's see, what's this here now? Oh, yes, economy contracts on weak gun sales outside the U.S., so we have to save some for export, guys. The CALM Act goes into effect. That's supposed to lower the volume of TV commercials. I said it lowers the volume of the commercials.
Yeah.
It's an effect. Yeah. Actually, the commercials are just as loud, but my hearing is softer, so it's actually worked out. Dow hits 14,000, but I don't feel it. Maybe when it hits 15,000, I'll feel it. I don't get it. You know, I never understood it, actually. 14,000 what? Points? Like you got on the back of Territon packs? For smoking them? What do you get? 14,000, what are they? They're points or something. What do you get for 14,000 points? It'd be something pretty nice, I think. I would think. All right. Never mind that. I was just thinking that. If Budweiser takes over Modelo Brewing, we'll have to pry the Corona out of my cold, dead mono. That's more of an editorial. Golfer Vijay Singh admits using curry. Here's the last Manti Te'o joke. Manti Te'o admits having a torrid two-year affair with Flo from Progressive Insurance. Last one. We're done now. That's it. Brett Favre will do some Super Bowl sideline coverage if Aaron Andrews is. There's where the Aaron Andrews came in handy, huh? Mercedes-Benz Superdome. That's not an oxymoron. And whatever the outcome, there will be noogies instead of handshakes after this Super Bowl. That's all the news that isn't. You know, because they're brothers, and it'll be this. It'll be this thing here. But I'll tell you one, you know, they say the Harbaughs, you know, no favorites. But, you know, one son looks like her, and one looks like him. And no matter what anybody says, that's significant. That's all I'm saying on that. If you're already tired of the Harbaughs and the Super Bowl and the brothers and you don't want to hear that and watch the parents the whole game, we have some alt Super Bowl things to do. Palo Alto, California, Menlo Schools, Upper School Drama Department presents 39 Steps, Florence Moore Auditorium on Valparaiso. Then if that doesn't work for you, we have the Gay Whistler Winter Pride Gay and Lesbian Ski Week in Whistler, British Columbia. It's a bit of a trip, but worth it. Okay. If that's not your cup of tea, how about Flights of Fancy, Stories for Children by Frank Ash at the Smithsonian in Washington? That would be quite nice. On Super Bowl Day. This is on Super Bowl Day, if you want an alternative. Men Stepping Up, A Call to Courageous Manhood has an event, but that's after the game. Or this here, Human Interaction Laboratory is going on in, where is this? In Seattle, naturally. Talaris. Seattle. Human Interaction Laboratory, February 3rd through 8th. So the whole week of human interaction will be almost too much for most men who are looking for an alternative. You can increase your emotional intelligence, improve your ability to communicate effectively. Generate a capacity to give and receive constructive feedback. This is so much better than a Super Bowl. Deepen your understanding of group processes and dynamics. I didn't even know there were such things. There's group processes. Increase your personal and group effectiveness in a diverse multicultural environment and build a personal foundation for more effective formal and informal leadership as well as personal and professional success. All this, guys, and defy the whole Super Bowl stigma. So think about it. That's all I'm saying. Price, $3,450. Well, okay. No. Looks like it's home with the Coronas. Stephen Tobolowsky, he's probably been in every movie you've ever seen. At some point, he enters the movie at some point, you notice, that's Stephen Tobolowsky. And if you don't know who I'm talking about, there's this.
Phil Connors, I thought that was you.
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for watching.
Hey. Now, don't you tell me you don't remember me, because I sure as heck fire remember you.
Not a chance.
Ned! Ryerson! Needle Nose Ned the Head, come on, buddy, Case Western High! Ned Ryerson, I did the whistling belly button trick at the high school talent show. Bing! Ned Ryerson got the shingles real bad senior year, almost didn't graduate. Bing! Again! Ned Ryerson, I dated your sister Mary Pat a couple times till you told me not to anymore. Well?
Ned Ryerson?
Bing!
Bing!
Here he is, Stephen Tobolowsky, ladies and gentlemen, from Seattle. How are you, Stephen?
I am doing very well. I'm in Seattle, as you mentioned now, and didn't you say there was some sort of human interaction kind
yes.
of thing going on? Am I missing that?
You can catch that. It's at the, what do they call it, Institute, the Talaris Institute there.
I think I'm headed for there when I finish with you.
Yeah.
I'm already having trouble here.
You'll need some human interaction after me, I think. It would be a change of pace. Now, Stephen, did you write that bit for the movie?
No. That bit was the bing, bing, bing bit was written for the movie. There was one piece I did write for the movie, though.
Oh.
This is a little bit of trivia.
Yeah.
And that is the last Ned scene in the movie where I come in and talk about all the different types of insurance that Bill Murray just bought for me. It was the greatest day of my life. That scene I did write for the movie because they had called me up and told me they wanted more Ned, but they hadn't written a scene yet. We were about to lose our location. So I just wrote that out quickly. I gave it to Bill. I gave it to Harold Ramis. We shot it, and that's my scene in the movie.
Yeah. How did you know that much about insurance? Did you have to research that? Or?
No, this is a lovely little, this is a little behind the scenes. People ask me how I came up with Ned, and I modeled some of it after my insurance man, Dennis. I remember when I finished, you know, Dennis was always trying to sell me insurance. When Groundhog Day came out, Dennis called me up on the phone and said, "Stephen, I got to tell you, I really loved your performance in the movie. I'm so tired of people making fun of insurance people. Finally, you showed us the way they really are."
Yeah, it was good. Classic movie. For I mean, it's in everyone's top 10, I think, of comedies. Certainly, don't you think?
I think one of the greatest moments I had in my parenthood life was when my youngest son was 11. He had not seen Groundhog Day, and I said, "Well, you know, you ought to see Groundhog Day. I think you and your friends would enjoy it." And he said, "No, it sounds really boring, Dad, and you're in it, and that sounds kind of boring." I said, "Well, I know. Just put it in and watch it." So I left the room, and they put it in the machine, and to hear the laughter come from the room, from my kid and his friends, was it did something to my. It was one of those moments as an actor you almost never have, where you actually feel good.
Yeah, feel good about what you're doing, and what
you feel good about anything.
About anything.
Anything.
Yeah. Now, do you ever feel like, you know, geology? Do you ever miss? You know, they think maybe you should have gone with the geology instead of the acting.
Oh, boy. No, I don't. I found when I was young, I loved rocks. And I thought that geology was where I wanted to go, and I studied geology, and I loved geology. But I since then learned that it's just as difficult to be a working geologist as it is a working actor.
Really?
There really aren't that many jobs for you out there. So I'm glad I stuck with a comfortable line of unemployment.
Do you have to audition as a geologist, too? You have to go in for a seat, get a gig? Or?
You know, you got to audition for everything in this world. That's the one thing they don't teach you in college. You have to audition for. I had to audition this morning to like get this coffee at Starbucks. It's so difficult.
It's got to be a problem. You walk into Starbucks and they're going to say, you know, the usual thing, Ned.
Does that get tiresome?
I'm
in an unusual place. I'm in Seattle, and so the negotiation. Where are you guys at? Are you in Wisconsin? Am I 2 or 3 hours different?
Madison, Wisconsin, yeah.
Madison, Wisconsin. Oh,
yeah.
So you're in the big city there.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
You know, it's considerably earlier here, and so it was far more difficult to communicate with the Starbucks person as usual. But, like you say, that seminar is coming up in human interaction, and if I hang over a little bit longer here in Seattle, we'll work out better tomorrow, I think.
Yeah. Now, when you go to school, you went to acting school in, was it SMU? Illinois is when you actually started the acting school, right?
Well, no, I did acting school at SMU.
Oh, you did as well.
In Dallas, Texas, and then I went to the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana.
Mm-hmm. I mean, is it actually hands-on and useful? I mean, obviously you learn acting techniques and so forth, but do they teach you how to audition, for example, and what you're going to have to go through emotionally?
No, it is completely useless. if there are any young actors out there in the sound of my voice and listening to your show, I found the problem with any acting school and the problem with college is that usually you work on things like Shakespeare, Chekhov, Shaw, Ibsen, Neil Simon. You work on pieces of material that make sense. And the authors that are trying to create those plays, those great classic plays, were trying to make a point and say something. When you audition for television or you audition for some movies, you're rarely working with material that makes sense at all.
Yeah, they don't ask you if you were in The Country Wife at a certain point.
No, they don't care if you were in The Country Wife. The number, like I worked on one script where I was Bill in the first part of the script and I was Ted in the second part of the script. And they had rewritten the script and changed who I was, but they didn't go back through and change the name.
Yeah.
So, but this happens all the time. I remember.
Well, did you go with the Bill or the Ted in that instance?
I went with both. Okay. And I was doing the movie with Richard Crenna, and he used to call me Bill Ted. And nobody caught on. We would rehearse the scene, and he'd say, well, Bill Ted, tell me. And nobody figured it out. And then when we shot the scene, he would just say Bill because he thought that was a better name than Ted.
Yeah.
But I remember here's an example. I underwent that open heart surgery thing, which was a traumatic kind of a thing, but it was a great thing. I mean, I've never felt better in my life. And there was a period of time where I couldn't work or couldn't get work. And so I sent an email out to all of my director writer friends. Could you help me out? Is there anything that you could write that I could be in? And one, Rob Hedden, writer-director, said, Stephen, I'm doing a movie now, and I've written a part for you. And he sent the script over to my house, and I was so excited. And I thought, you know, is it going to be Hamlet? Is it going to be Horatio? And I keep turning through the pages looking for my part. The part started on page 78. And it was the part of Butt Crack Plumber. And I'm thinking, he wrote this for me. I show up on the set, and the costume director says, well, could you get on your hands and knees? And could you stick your head under the sink? And I hear him whispering to his assistant, saying, well, you know, I really don't see much crack. How did you get this part? And I said, you know, I knew the director. But you don't learn stuff like that when you're in college.
No, they should probably tell you that.
No.
Especially to get down on your hands and knees part. That could probably come in handy in some of these.
Yeah, that comes in handy often.
Yeah, some of these auditions. Now, I have I think it's a partial list of what you've been in.
Yeah.
So can we go through it? It's only about 400 pages long. Let's start. Keep My Grave Open is your first credit, 1976. You were Robert. Yeah.
I played Robert the stable boy, and I was murdered with a samurai sword in the shower.
What a part, though. Huh? For your first part, that's great.
It was a great part, and I remember the director said he was going to shoot two versions. One version where I'm covered with blood in the shower, that would be the R-rated version, and then the version where they don't cover me with blood in the shower, and that would be the GP version. It was, you know, I think it's still available.
Yeah.
In England, it became kind of a cult film in England, and I think it's available on DVD or something there. Keep My Grave Open.
That was,
I have hair in that one.
Okay, then we go to Cocaine and Blue Eyes, which is a TV movie. And was that the O.J.? movie?
That was the one where I got to work with the inimitable O.J. Simpson.
Yeah.
I played, in that one, I played a porno store clerk. if there are any young actors out there, you'll notice that there's a sort of hierarchy in Hollywood about when you have a name and when you don't have a name. If you have a good part, you usually have two names. Like Harrison Ford always has two names, like Richard Kimball. Johnny Depp always has two names, and even, you know, Captain Jack Sparrow. But then there's a hierarchy lower than that, where you just get your name and the job profession.
Yeah.
And, like, if it's a comedy, I found out that you get your name and your first name and the job, like Sheriff Charlie, Ringmaster Bob. If it's a drama, you get your job profession and your last name, like Officer McLaren. That kind of thing, Father Donnelly, something like that.
Yeah.
If you go lower on the totem pole, you get things like Porno Sore Clerk. You don't have a name, you just have a job. And then it gets even worse than that if you get Butt Crack Plumber. That gets to be anatomical parts and your job. That's really bad. But the interesting thing about Cocaine and Blue Eyes was we rehearsed that scene, and I met O.J. Simpson, who was incredibly charming.
Yeah.
This was before he was a multiple murderer or accused of that.
Yeah.
And we rehearsed the scene, but then we didn't shoot it for a long time, like a couple hours, and I didn't know what happened, what was going on. And they were rebuilding the floor in the porno shop so O.J. could be taller than I was.
Oh,
yeah. So they built a 2-inch ramp to where he could do the scene, and he was taller than I was, is what they were doing.
Well, you're 6'3"?
Yeah, I'm 6'3", and O.J. was probably about 6'1".
Yeah.
So, yeah, they built him up.
He did. So didn't they ask you once if you could play 6'6"?
Yeah, that was bad. That was they don't teach you that in school either.
Yeah.
It was my first agent in Hollywood.
Yeah.
Said her name was Carol Farrell, and she said, "Stephen, I have a audition for you." This was like the first day I got her. I ran over there, and this was before the age of cell phones or before the age of fax machines or anything. So I ran over to get the material, and she said, "How tall are you?" And I said, "I'm 6'3". And she's looking at the character breakdown, and she said, "Can you be 6'6? And I said, "Well, with 3-inch heels, I could be 6'6.
Yeah.
It was to play the part of a basketball player. And that's when I realized that this agent may not be for me, because the rules, the physical laws of the universe didn't seem to apply to her.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So, but I notice here in looking through this, it seems you get two names. You're Steve Comiskey and Knott's Landing. So that must have been sort of a breakthrough year for you.
Yeah, that was a difficult kind of a role. I went out to the wine country to do Knott's Landing, and before I was Steve Comiskey, I was Doctor. The role was Doctor, and I only had three words you know, it was one line with three little words, and so I have learned those three words. And then that morning, the director said, "Do you want to work on the part together?" And I said, "Well, no, it's okay. I think I've got it." And he says, "You've got it?" And I said, "Sure, I've got it. No problem." We arrive on the set, and I see everybody has different colored scripts than I do. And I don't know if your audience knows, but whenever there's a rewrite in Hollywood, they change the color of the pages so you know which version you're in. It's like a rock layer, stratified rock layer. I was working off of white pages. They were working off of green pages. And that's when they said, "Could we bring Steve Comiskey in?" And I'm just standing there, and everybody's looking at me, and they said, "You're on." And I'm going, "What?" I see that they have rewritten the script, and instead of my one line, I now have an entire scene filled with medical jargon, filled with all sorts of technical hospital data, subdural hematoma. We're going to do the magnetic resonance imaging, all these kind of lines. And I felt like I was going to pass out, and the director said, "Do you not know the scene?" I said, "I've never seen the scene before in my life."
Yeah.
I said, "Give me 10 minutes. Give me 10 minutes and let me see what I can memorize, and then we'll shoot it." And boy, this was back in the age when I had a brain cell left.
Yeah.
So I actually learned the scene. It was like 3 or 4 pages of dialogue with medical jargon. I learned it in about 10 minutes, we shot all my stuff, and then I passed out.
Yeah. So, but you're a pretty quick study, right? I mean, to be a character actor, you pretty much have to be, right? I mean, a quick study and a good study. You got to know how to bring life to a character that has sort of limited, you know, screen time in a short space, yes, and really convey a lot about that character. So, but you're great at that.
Well, you have to know what kind of questions to ask. I remember once I was playing lawyer, right? Again, lawyer means nothing. Now, if I were a woman playing the same part, it would say lawyer attractive. So I was playing lawyer, and it was one of those, how do you play lawyer? Lawyer does not exist. I mean, are you a good lawyer, a bad lawyer? Are you the first person in your family that was ever received a graduate degree? Do you come from a long line of lawyers? You know, all sorts of detailed questions you could ask, but no, the writers say lawyer, which means nothing.
Yeah.
It just so happened that this biopic with Veronica Hamill, my lawyer was a real guy who lived in Texas, and he was still alive. So I called him up on the phone, and I felt it was indiscreet to ask if he was a good lawyer or a bad lawyer. But I did ask the first question. I said, did you always want to be a lawyer? And he said, oh, God, no. No, I always wanted to be a country western singer. He says, in fact, I have my guitar in my office, and while I interview people, I'm trying to write a country song. I hope to be in Nashville someday. So I go into the set the next day with my guitar, talk to the producer and director, and said, I have a new idea for lawyer. And so while I was doing my boring scene with Veronica, not that Veronica was boring or I was particularly boring, but the scene was, you know, just exposition, I started writing a country song there, and suddenly the scene came to life.
Yeah.
But it kind of underscores, if there are, again, any young actors out there in the sound of our voice, I have learned a lesson through hard experience, is that true always trumps clever.
Yeah.
So if you could find an element in your character that is true, it will be more important. Well, like Ned in Groundhog Day, of being able to find some elements from Dennis, my real insurance guy,
yeah,
that says, I'm telling the truth, even though Ned was a bit of an exaggeration.
Yeah. Now, I guess I'm a little surprised, maybe people are surprised, that you were given that little direction in terms of what your character is about in these movies. I mean, you have to bring the whole character to life yourself.
Yes. You have to do. Now, when you're Harrison Ford,
yeah,
or when you're Johnny Depp,
right,
all of those things are kind of in the script. In fact, you even often have to take a shower in the show if you're Harrison Ford or Johnny Depp. Or you have to drink coffee or eat breakfast. They have all of that stuff in the script, screen time.
Have you never taken a shower except a bloody one? Is that... As a character,
I'm trying to think if on Californication, if I had to take a shower once. I don't think so, but no. I had to run around in my all together and on that show.
Yeah.
But as a character actor, you have to do all of that work on your own, and you have to be able to ask the right questions. And here's a question out there. If there are writers out there, which I know there are, who listen to you, and again, actors, there's one question that I always ask that I always find is a great question and gets to the heart of the matter. And that is, what is my greatest hope and what is my greatest fear?
Mm-hmm.
If you could answer those two questions about your character, you could play anything from Romeo to Juliet.
Mm-hmm. From Romeo to Juliet.
Yeah, yes. Anything in between, too.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's very interesting. The greatest hope and greatest fear. And so in the sense,
yeah,
of you know the parameters of the character.
Yeah, you take a look at like Ned Ryerson.
Yeah.
You know, Ned's greatest hope was that he was going to be an enormously successful life insurance agent. His greatest hope was that he would be enormously successful at what he would do. His greatest fear was that he was an outcast in high school and he had no friends.
Right.
So in all of my interactions with Bill Murray, I am trying desperately to engage him and desperately be his friend. That all came from greatest hope and greatest fear.
That's really amazing. And this is all, this is what you taught yourself, basically. You learned yourself.
And it's, I had a great, boy, it's hard to say he was a great acting teacher. He was such a monster at times. At the University of Illinois, Ed K. Martin was a pretty brutal guy at times, but he turned out to be an incredibly decent and truthful man. And he had some great insights into acting, and that was one of his. Greatest hope and greatest fear I learned from Ed, and it turned out to be true. He turned out to be a dear, dear friend and supporter later on when I wasn't in school anymore. And he passed away, he passed away about 20 years ago now. But I still remember him, and everybody who took classes from Ed remember him, too. I run into people who took classes from Ed all the time. He left his mark in the world.
Yeah. Was that the class where you had to do one art form in another art form?
No.
That was a different class.
That was different. Yeah, that was a visualization.
Visualization.
In class, when you were in college, you do a lot of classes that are meaningless. But when you're in graduate school, you do tons of classes that are meaningless. And this one class we had to do was called visualization.
Right.
And that's where you had to see an art form on Thursday, like go to the art museum and see a picture. And then you had to translate that art form into another art form on Tuesday. Well, you know, this is total BS because nobody is going to go see a painting on Thursday and write a symphony for Tuesday. That isn't going to, they're not going to write a novel. What they're going to do is they're going to come up with some kind of street theater demonstration of something that's totally useless in any application. So what I did, on Thursday, we went to see a Zen painting. It was of a monk sitting on a mountaintop with a vast amount of open sky above him. So I told the entire class they had to go out and wait in the coffee area till I set up the classroom for my demonstration. So they all left with giggling anticipation because they knew I was going to come up with something really, really funny. So they left. I went in. I took off all of my clothes. I put my underwear in my pants. I put my socks in my shoes. I sat my clothes at my desk and wrote on a piece of paper, "This too will pass." Then from the paper bag I had, I pulled out a bathrobe, put it on, snuck out of the room, went downstairs to the dressing rooms where I had another set of clothing, and I walked home. So I left them all at the coffee place. Now, the report I got back was that after 20 minutes, Bernard Hobgood, our teacher, was getting a little antsy that my setup was taking too long. After 40 minutes, he was furious and came marching down with the entire class pounding on the door saying, "Stephen, enough of this. It's gone on too long. It's gone on too long." And finally, he burst through the door, and there he was greeted with the me and my underwear and my socks with the little sign on the desk saying, "This too will pass." And that was my visualization. I was at home at that time drinking a Rolling Rock beer, watching Ironsides on TV. That was my Zen demonstration for the class.
And eating a steak biscuit probably at that point.
Eating an Ireland steak and biscuit, yes.
Yeah. Stephen, it's been a joy talking with you. I wish we had more time to do it. And I know things are going on right now. What are you doing right now? I read that you're working on Californication, I know.
Californication, I just did Justified, which is a fabulous, well, both Californication and Justified are just fabulous shows. One is violent and one is very sexual, but if you're not squeamish, they're both really great. I'm still involved with the book tour for the Dangerous Animals Club. So I'm in Seattle tonight. I'm doing a book signing and a Groundhog Day event. And then next week I'm in Dallas and then New York. And what I do is I'll do stories live and then do a book signing. And I believe we're going to be recording some more stories for PRI, which is enormously exciting.
Yeah.
And that'll be coming to hopefully a station near everybody.
Yes, near you. The Dangerous Animals Club is the book. Stephen Tobolowsky, thank you so much, Stephen.
Thank you so much.
It's been a great pleasure. I love it. Take care.
Thank you.
Stephen Tobolowsky, this is the book, Dangerous Animals Club. And they're all stories of his career and his feeling. He's always thinking. He's a thinker. There's a lot of philosophy in here and ideas, and it's not just about show business but by any means. And, oh, I didn't get to ask him. And when he went to Hollywood, his mother went with him. I thought that, I really wanted to mention that. Mentioned going to Hollywood. His big break, finally he's going to go to Hollywood and do it. And his mom drove with him there. Found a place for him and set it up.
I can't place his face. His voice sounds familiar, but I'm sure I've seen him.
Here's his face. Yeah.
Oh, that's what I thought. Okay.
Ned Ryerson.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Okay. Yeah.
Ned.
Yeah, yeah.
Ned Ryerson. Needle Nose.
Needle Nose.
Needle Nose. Yeah. Great stuff. Okay. All right then there. Okay. I heard you tooling around on the piano there, Mr. Tulin.
Tulin?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You were tooling on the piano there.
I was, yeah.
Getting anxious to play something, are you?
Yeah, sort of.
Is this the number you're thinking
about? This is the number. It's called Booker's Bossa.
Sounds good. John Tulin. Jeff Hammond on the bass. Make it quick.
Once again, it's Michael Feldman.
Make it quick doesn't make any sense. Let's see now. How do I get to meet Sarah Nix? Where is that?
I could set that up for you.
How does one meet Sarah? Sarah, you want to respond to that?
I didn't write that card.
No. Okay, all right. I'm going to let you worry about that problem then. Mark Jaberg. Howard's Grove, minister. Jaberg.
Jaberg.
Why am I here? Oh. Possible sermon topic. Huh? Tomorrow. It's tomorrow. Okay, work with this experience, this feeling you're having here. Put it into a sermon. You got it. Made. Go what?
Go too long?
Okay, another sermon. Going too long. No, okay. I don't know why you're here. Someone drag you here? Minister?
Yes. 2 months ago, my wife said, let's go to Hawaii.
Yeah.
And we went to Hawaii a month ago.
Yeah.
Wednesday, she said, let's come here.
Yeah.
Here we are.
My wife. He works in strange ways, doesn't he? And so does she, let's face it. Okay, Hawaii and here. Those are the two things you got so far?
Great,
okay.
Great life.
Yeah, okay. Well, you take orders well. That's the main thing. What's your ideal first date? Dana wants to know. Where's Dana? Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
You have to understand it would be my first date in 30 years. So there's that to it, you know. So a little hard to say exactly how I would approach that.
Well, what was your ideal first date? 30?
Who remembers? You know how long ago that was? First date? I don't know. I remember going to a movie with a girl, Sonny, Sonia Berman. We called her Sonny. We went to a movie. We went to see Sound of Music, Uptown Theater in Milwaukee, whatever year that was. Sat behind some nuns. And I actually... I thought I might have held her hand. I don't know. I certainly thought about it for about half the movie, which wasn't that great anyway. And that was my actual first date ever. And that was it. So,
lovely. Sounds like a good time.
Yeah, it was very lovely. It was very lovely. I don't recommend that as an approach. Sitting behind nuns at Sound of Music is not a good. How are we doing time-wise?
Sure. We have about a minute.
Oh, about a minute. Okay. 15 hours from Pawpaw. It's 15 hours from Papa?
Yeah, probably 16, actually. We got lost.
Yeah. Where did you get lost?
Around Pittsburgh.
Around Morgantown. Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. What was the problem there? Bridge?
Oh, the GPS got tricky.
You use a GPS?
I'm going to try not to anymore.
Yeah.
I was the map holder.
Oh, yeah.
She navigates and the GPS navigates, and between the two of them, it gets confusing.
Do they get in arguments about, you know, where the voice comes on and you argue with it? Yeah,
it does. The voice did come on yesterday.
Yeah. What did the voice say?
It said, you just go ahead and follow the GPS, and I'll look at the map. And then I said...
That was GPS said that?
Yes,
that was you.
It was, no. Yeah, never mind.
No, we turn the voice off of the GPS. Yeah. That we don't listen to that.
Mine is always saying, recalculating, because I don't follow their directions. So recalculating, you know, why didn't you think of it in the first place? You shouldn't have to recalculate.
Yeah, we turn that off. I just look at that. And then occasionally Sam will look at the map, and she'll say suddenly, turn there. And then 45 minutes later, the GPS is saying, no, you never should have done that.
Recalculating.
Right.
Which is what happened, yes. That did happen yesterday.
And then we got to Chicago at 6 o'clock, which was not a good idea. And the GPS took us through the city. I mean, does that make any
sense? Did it say why?
No, I was trying to figure that out. But we did come at the other end.
That's a good place to end, actually. We got your name is?
Joe Herman.
Joe and?
Sam.
And Sam?
Yes.
Nice to have you. You were on the show before, right?
Sam was.
We were. Yeah. And you lost. I'm so sorry. Thanks for coming all the way. Okay, we got to play the What Do You Know quiz here, because that's what we do, being a quiz show. We have to legally, for tax purposes. Who would I give the four disclaimers to? Oh, right here. Can I get you to stand up here and deliver that right now? Stand and deliver, if you would. You are?
I'm Craig Worrell.
All right. Craig, take that.
Hello, everyone. All right. All questions used on What Do You Know have been painstakingly researched, although the answers have not. Ambiguous, misleading, or poorly worded questions are far for the course. Listeners who are sticklers for the truth should get their own shows. All right, number two. Time of year, you weren't for a warm car and closed garage.
Let me help you with this one. It's the time of year you want to warm the car up in a closed garage.
Ah, there we go. It wasn't the handwriting. No. No, okay. Number three. Persons employed by the International House of Radio or its member stations are lucky to be working at all, let alone tying up the office phones trying to play the quiz. Listeners who have won recently should sit on their hands and let someone else have a chance for a change. All right, number four. All opinions, you like the numbers, the numbering system? All right.
I like the way you're playing with the camera.
Okay. All opinions expressed on What Do You Know are well-reasoned and insightful. Needless to say, they are not those of the International House of Radio, its member stations or lackeys. Anyone who says otherwise is itching for a fight.
Well done. Fabulous. Step for my line there, which you really do. But I'm going to work on that. We'll get back to that. Let's see the hands of those of you who want to try them in the quiz. Chance to win fabulous prizes just for being fabulous. And knowing, he drove 15 hours. 15 hours. 15 hours.
Yes.
And that's not even including time in Chicago, right?
That includes the time in Chicago.
Oh, it does. Okay.
Includes everything.
Otherwise, it would have been
the whole bit.
And your name once again is?
Joe.
Joe?
Herman.
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 Okay. Joe Herman, come on down here. You deserve it just for the effort. Yes. Come on down up here. Joe Herman. Sam did it the last time, and she actually lost on that.
You let her lose.
How do you mean I let her lose?
It doesn't happen very often.
No,
I've been listening.
Almost never. She must have annoyed me or something. Did she say something that was annoying to me? Or do you recall
saying
anything?
No, she's always
pleasant.
You
look so nice.
I'm naive, and so I don't.
She trusted you.
Oh, big mistake.
I put Sam down here, but actually it's Joe. Right?
Right.
Joe Herman.
Right.
Okay.
All Michael.
Right. Yeah.
Feldman.
So how are things back there in Paw Paw?
Things are good.
Yeah.
Not so cold as this.
No, it's not. How cold is it getting, Papa?
Oh, we have had a cold spell, but not like this.
No.
It gets, we've been down to in the teens.
Yeah.
But not six. What is it here today?
It was five.
Five, yeah.
Well, it might be six by now. It was one for the longest time. It was really starting to annoy me. You know what I'm saying? It was like 1 degree, and I could see that as a transitional number. But for it to linger as long as it did at 1 degree, it was almost, it didn't make sense.
Sorry, I missed that.
Yeah, it was really quite something. I sort of enjoyed it for a bit. But, like, you know, one.
One. Boring.
It's, yeah. Just, and it was zero for a while, too, but that was sort of cool.
That's exciting.
Wow, we're at zero. It's kind of exciting. I don't know why, but one is just annoying. Hate it when that happens. So what are you doing out there in Pawpaw these days, Joe?
I play music.
What are you playing?
Fiddle, guitar, sing.
Did you bring all your stuff?
Yeah, it's over at the hotel.
Okay.
You want to run, go get it?
Yeah. So are you in a band, or you perform as a...
Sam and I are traveling.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no kidding. Fantastic. Mm-hmm. We got a gig lined up around here?
We're going to Canada.
Canada?
Yeah, we're doing...
Did you think that's where you were... your GPS really screwed you up on this one?
Yeah, right. I hear it's cold up there, too.
Yeah. Where are you playing in Canada?
Manitoba and Saskatchewan.
Yeah? You got the gig lined up or some just
some friends or an organization out of Winnipeg called Home Roots.
Oh, cool.
They're all home concerts, so we go from one home to the next, and they feed us, and they house us. And
that's
they
fantastic.
Give us pockets full of money.
And what are you called, so that if we want to get in on this, we know what to...
I'm Joe Herman, and this is Sam.
Yeah. But, I mean, is there a name for the group or the band?
In this case, it's just Joe and Sam, but, yeah, we have a group called Critton Hollow String Band.
Oh, fantastic.
It is fantastic.
That's so cool. All right, we got to play the quiz here because we're running a little late here, so we got to get to that right now, and we have qualifying questions. Is that how it works, Sarah Nix?
Yeah, that's pretty much how it works. People call.
Do you have to wear that hood? You're very
it's
upsetting to me. Yeah, but you're wearing a black hood during my show, and I feel like you're deaf.
It's navy blue.
I feel like death is there.
Shall I give you the number now?
Yes, but
yes. Okay. The number, if people want to play the quiz, is 1-800-942-5669, and you ask them a qualifying question.
Okay, of European toddlers, which are the pickiest eaters? So you got to pick a country in Europe where the children, the toddlers, are the pickiest eaters. And this has actually been studied. I don't know, I'm not sure why. Pickiest eaters in Europe among toddlers. What country would that be, Paul, in Woodstock?
Good question.
Pickiest eaters of toddlers in Europe.
Well, I'm thinking that in Scotland they have all the haggis and stuff, but that's probably going to be very upsetting to the young.
You're saying Scotland. So, really, what you're saying is the UK.
The UK in general, yeah.
That's right, the UK. All right. I don't know if it's the haggis in Scotland, but you got it, Paul.
Nice going, Paul.
Nice going. You aced that one. And, Paul, what do you do there in Woodstock these days?
I work in Chicago.
Okay.
I don't have to drive through it. I do take the train.
Yeah. What line are you in?
And I do proposal writing in downtown Chicago.
Proposal writing. Okay.
Not for people trying to get married or anything. But.
Okay. Yeah, I get it. Paul and Joe. Joe?
Paul? Hi, Paul.
Hey there.
Let's work this out, huh?
Okay. You guys are a team right now, okay? You bonded enough for that?
Sure. And Woodstock Willie the Groundhog did not see a shadow, by the way.
Oh, the Woodstock Groundhog.
Thank you for the update. Right.
Didn't see it. Okay. Is that good or bad? I don't remember how that works.
That's good. That means we're in early spring.
Okay. All right. Because I think the other one had the same result, so... Very excited about that. So we have various categories here, don't we, Sarah Nix?
We do. And those categories are current events, people, places, things you should have learned in school had you been paying attention, science, and odds and ends.
Okay, Paul, you pick the first one.
People.
People, these are kind of survey results. Let's see if they are. Yes. Get out of there, Joe. Out of 10 American people, how many truly believe that God roots for certain teams, certain sports teams? Is it 9, 5, or 3 out of 10 Americans believe that?
Americans are funny like that. Let's see.
Yeah, but to truly believe that God would root for a specific sports team, I mean, Cubs fans, we're probably different. But
Yeah, I know. Yeah. That's beyond help, even divine help, I think.
I think I'd have to go with the 3.
I'm thinking 3.
3 is right, yes. All right. Okay. 3 out of 10.
All right.
That is one right and no wrong.
What's left there, Sarah?
Current events, places, things you should have learned in school, science, or odds and ends.
Okay.
Things you should have learned in school. Let's try that.
Let's see here what you should have learned. What is the evolutionary advantage of having hands that wrinkle up in the bathtub? There's no answers here. You should have learned this in school, apparently.
Evolutionary. Maybe it helps for gripping or something. If you've got the more wrinkles, maybe it helps with gripping or something.
You mean that, gripping like in a wet environment?
Exactly what I was going to say.
Were you?
Yeah.
That's right. That is so cool. You guys really are a dynamic duo. But now Sam is feeling so bad that you're doing your ace in this.
This is going to be a problem, right?
Yeah, it's going to be a problem on the long drive home with the GPS.
That's two right and no wrong.
Okay, leaving us with?
Places, science, or odds and ends.
Places, science, odds and ends. Paul, what do you think?
Odds and ends.
Odds and ends, okay. If you walk up a flight of stairs to have sex, how many calories will you burn?
During the walk or later?
No, the whole event.
The whole event. Oh.
Yeah, 150, 363, or who's counting?
Who's counting, Paul?
Yeah, I would go
who's counting. Yes, we have to eliminate that because that's the gag answer. So we're left with 150 or 363 total calories walking up a flight of stairs to have sex.
Walking up the flight. How long is the flight?
How long is the sex? I mean, there's all kinds of variables here.
If you're walking up the steps of the Capitol, you know, it's probably the 360.
Why are you having sex in the Capitol?
360.
Or 150?
150 is what I was going to say. Yeah.
Oh, okay. 150. What do you think, Paul?
I think that sounds pretty good.
Holy cow. You guys are unbelievable. You won it like a three straight. Holy cow. Well, the way I see it, you could quit now, or you could try to get this one last right and get everything, right?
That is correct.
Okay. You want to try that?
No, I think we better quit.
You're quitting.
I'm kidding.
Okay. We got to do this quick, though. Paul, okay. Are you in on this?
I'm in on it.
Okay. Got to get this one right and get the giant kielbasa or whatever it is these days. What's left there, Sarah?
The categories left are current events, places, or science.
Science.
Okay. Science it is.
Is it my turn?
Yes. The Zeigarnik effect. Zeigarnik. I'm sorry. The Zeigarnik effect in psychology. Is it the flight, fight? Or when you keep telling the same story over and over again? Or fixating on unfinished tasks? In psychology, the Zeigarnik effect. Talk it over. After Zeigarnik, I presume. Who did one of these things, apparently.
Maybe fight, flight, do you think?
Flight, fight, or when you keep telling the same story over and over.
I think
or,
it's when you keep telling the same
story. Or even fixating on unfinished tasks.
I was going to say, it's not that, it's that fixating on unfinished tasks.
You think that was what Zeigarnik was known for?
Sort of got a feeling for that.
I think if we don't say unfinished, we're going to be unfinished.
Unfinished tasks? Yes, that's right, the Zeigarnik effect. In psychology, fixating on the unfinished. What do they want, Sarah?
Joe, while waiting in your ice shanty for the fish to bite, you can pass the time playing a miniaturized version of cribbage. Its handcrafted hardwood case has a trapdoor revealing the deck of cards and playing pins from the Duluth Trading Company. And then read Rhoda Jansen's Does This Church Make Me Look Fat? A Mennonite Finds Faith, Meets Mr. Right, and Solves Her Lady Problems from Grand Central Publishing. Continue with Fat is the New 30 by Sweet Potato Queen Jill Connor Brown from Amazon Publishing. And discover 586 pounds of feminine charm, the story of Ella Mills, the last fat Lady of the Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey Circus by Pat Grand from Behringer Publishing. Paul, you'll start your day with the richly satisfying breakfast blend and continue that Java vibe with the flavorful, rich Costa Rican Terrazzo, precision roasted in Madison by Stephen Brew Coffee, coffee done right. Then combine music and eating with Sharon O'Connor's Cooking with the Blues, New American Comfort Food and Recipes, All American Blues, featuring the music of Danny Caron Band with Charles Brown from Music Cooks. Quaff your favorite brew from a fine-looking mug from Michigan Public Television. And acquire book learning painlessly. With What Do You Know, test your knowledge with the ultimate collection of amazing trivia, quizzes, stories, fun facts, and everything else you never knew you wanted to know by Michael Feldman from Bristol Park Books. Congratulations to you both.
And to you. Thank you, man. Good to see you. Congratulations. Share this with Sam. You got this.
Yeah. Michael Feldman's What Do You Know is produced by Wisconsin Public Radio for PRI, Public Radio International.
Finally a winner.
Michael Feldman, producer international. This is PRI, Public Radio International. Live from the Monona Terrace Community and Convention Center, it's Michael Feldman's What Do You Know from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. That's John Tulin on piano, Jeff Hammond on bass. I'm Sarah Nix. In this hour of What Do You Know, author and playwright Nathan Englander, thanks for the memos and more of the What Do You Know quiz. Support for What Do You Know comes from PRI affiliate stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And now, the man who's rated M for Michael, it's Michael Feldman.
Not for mature, we know that. always like those. The worse the video game is, they always say rated M for mature. You know. Well, you know, each week at this time we. What do we do? Memos.
Memos.
We do memos sent in by actual listeners, and thanks for the memos. What it's called, and this is a memo here. This is an order that was submitted. People ordered a set of books from a publisher, and this is the feedback on it for their book order and the condition in which it was received. Okay, so this is it's comments on The Complete Wreck, A Series of Unfortunate Events, books 1 through 13, hardcover by Lemony Snicket. Condition good. Description good, complete 13 volume hardcover set, no box. Books are in good condition. Some minor edge cover wear to a couple, but overall a great collection. Enjoy good with average wear to cover pages and binding. That was the description of the book. This is the response to receiving it. In the above referenced order, The Complete Wreck as pictured was not delivered and may be considered an epilogue to the series of unfortunate events. What arrived today, December 27th, a full 12 days after reported shipment date stated, was a hodgepodge assemblage of some various volumes of the Lemony Snicket series of unfortunate events. The condition of this set varies significantly by volume. A couple of them seem to be like new. Others are well worn but reasonable. Others seem a potential health risk. Volume 1 near new. Volume 2 has a tacky 1x2 adhesive residue on back cover. Volume 3, slight binding damage, near new otherwise. Volume 4, other than the green $1.50 sticker adhered on the front cover, good condition. Volume 5, had apparent spine repair and some random children's stickers applied to the front cover. 6, a reasonable condition, but along with the 7 and 12 have inventory control stickers on the spine. 7 has either oatmeal cookie or a booger on its front cover. And the aforementioned inventory control sticker on its spine. Volume 8 has another 1x2 patch of adhesive residue and torn cover. Volume 9, good shape. Volume 10 has survived some sort of splattering, food fight, or bloody sneeze, literally. It is difficult to determine, nor am I sure I want to. Volume 11, though intact, appears to have suffered a lengthy confinement loss, perhaps in the bottom of a satchel shared by loose crayons and uncapped felt-tip markers. Volume 12, again, the inventory control sticker on the spine and some more unidentified smudgery smear on its front cover. 13, would otherwise be in reasonable condition except for some cake on dried substance, again, reminiscent of either oatmeal cookie dough or its unpleasant alternative. To summarize, 12 days to be delivered, shipped on the 15th of December, delivered on the 27th, just in time for next Christmas. With an expedited handwritten note below a stricken standard delivery statement is difficult to understand. Fortunately, this was not my child's only gift. Well, thank you so much for that. An actual memo, because you can't make this stuff up. Although you can try. And where can they send these memos or any other communication that they might want to send?
They can send them to whatdoyouknow@wpr.org, subject line memos, or go to notmuch.com and find a spot to post it there.
Thank you for removing the hood.
You're welcome.
I feel much better now.
I get pneumonia, it's all on you.
Okay. All right. But the sickle was going too far, I thought. Okay. Nathan Englander is one of the most talented, I think, and one of the hottest writers currently in America, really. In fact, globally, he's a global writer now. And why he's in Madison, Wisconsin, we have trouble finding out. But we're going to find out right now. He's with us, Nathan Englander, joining us right now on our stage here in Madison, Wisconsin. And how are you? Good to meet you. I can't believe you're going to leave the glories of 5-degree Madison, Wisconsin for what? For Israel?
Yeah, I'm leaving on Tuesday, I think. So.
Yeah. How can you leave this all behind?
Well, I just thought, you know, now that they're bombing Syrian convoys, it'd be a great time to have a visit.
Good time to make a visit. Now, what is your connection here in Madison? I've heard that you were here. We do have some, like, celebrity types in Madison. Well, Lori Moore, I know. She's not far from me.
Yeah, and Lori's she's a friend.
Yeah, but is Madison some sort of a literary capital
That's funny. I thought Laurie was going to get a restraining order against me. You know, I was looking for the writer's mafia. I was like, you want to have lunch? Want to have breakfast? Want to have a drink? So she's in New York this semester, and I think it may be because I came back. But sitting in the audience is my wife, Rachel, who is getting a couple of PhDs here. So
she is. What's she in?
Educational Policy Studies and Anthropology.
Do we know what that is yet? Or are we still?
I have a general idea.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Can one make a living at that? Is the important question.
Oh, it's... She would scream out no. But yes, it's a great thing. Yeah, she actually had been working the Dadaab refugee camps on the Kenya-Somali border with women's refugee education and got interested in that and now has sort of switched her research to Malawi. And I think I always say one person in every couple should be nice. I think it makes a nice balance. Yeah.
So you're not the nice one?
No. No, I try to be. I try to be.
Try to be. Now, were you born in the Bronx or in Queens? Or?
It's one of those rolling facts. According to wherever you look, I get born in lots of places. Yeah. But I used to hide from it for a long time, but I was born in Long Island, Strong Island, New York.
Yeah. Oh, you were?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
And did you go to school out there?
Yes, it was. This is, I need a whiteboard for this. I can use your map and show the motion of Jewish folk in the 60s from, Lower East Side to Brooklyn and then out to Long Island to have, front yards. So yes, my parents were part of building a little Jewish ghetto in suburbia in which I was raised.
Yeah. And you were Orthodox?
Full on, yeah. 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 Is today Saturday?
It is, yes.
And so. I shouldn't be on the radio.
No, you shouldn't be. Exactly. But I think there's dispensation for this.
Yeah,
I'm not
think
sure
so,
why.
Exactly.
I think Rabbi Twersky probably.
Exactly.
I loved what we talk about when we talk about Anne Frank. It's a great collection of stories.
Thank you so much.
And there's a couple of reasons. One, because it means there is actually still a Jewish writer. And we used to be able to back up a long time. When I went to school here at the University of Wisconsin, a life-changing course for me was I took a course on Jewish writers. And I read the Malamud and of course, Bello and all these people. And I love the fact, I guess what I liked about it the best was that they were writing about my father's generation of newcomers.
Yes.
Coming to this country, and the guys who would do anything to make a living, basically, and all the family interactions and so forth. But they go on to Philip Roth.
Yes.
And there's like a sea change, and it's suddenly, well, he's the Americanized, and he's the rebel, and so forth. And it was like that period was over where there was someone writing, the writer actually writing about that, and not sort of rebelling against it. And then there's you.
Yeah. Yes, here
and
I am.
And it's like, yeah.
Yeah, well, I guess, it sort of maps, that's what literature does. It's both this, there's the books and the stories, and then there's a way you can, if I already mentioned anthropology, but you can map it sort of anthropologically.
Yeah.
But sort of this idea where I feel like I really do look at those generations, and Philip's turning 80, this happy birthday to him.
Yeah.
But he's, you see this idea of like Singer, there was the people, in my father's court where, they were breaking out into the world, and then there was this idea of these American writers, all the dreams. Roth's the perfect example of dreaming of going to the secular college, going to the yuppie college, going to the, being preppy, dating the blonde girl, this idea of being Americanized. And I feel like that was that generation's fight. It's hard for me even to imagine places that didn't, the next town over where Jews, couldn't buy a house or weren't hired for a job. I think it's sort of the success of America that, the success of that this melting pot idea. And, as we have our, black president for his, second term, it's miraculous. But I think the success of that generation of Jews in truly becoming American allowed for, my generation to be utterly, ghettoized again. I think that was this idea of like first acceptance and then this idea of the special interest group where, after acceptance where they could send us to Jewish schools and utterly, close us off. So for me, I feel like almost closer to the generation before, like Singer's generation, for me being out in the world is a wildly exciting thing. I, had this truly sheltered, Long Island shtetl existence.
Yeah, yeah. Not so different from Milwaukee. I don't know. It's a funny thing because, I'm certainly Americanized. But you have this background, and your parents had this background that was so different from your own, and the things they had to deal with. And even this concept of anti-Semitism or something, I tell it to my daughters and stuff, they don't know what I'm talking about. They've never had, no one's even said, a nasty thing to them, apparently.
Right.
And I'm glad for that. But, at the same time, I think, they should know, how we suffered and what happened, and all this stuff and all that. But it's hard to explain to them. I grew up in Milwaukee, which is basically a German city,
yes,
with juice sprinkled around it, and you know, and we, yeah, and that's why this the story you have about the Blums.
Oh yeah, that was How We Avenged the Blums, which is a story about, yeah, these kids having a battle with the local anti-Semite.
So. Yeah, who turns out to be Jewish, actually. Isn't he? He was half Jewish. Half, so.
Well, I always like that. It's a very strange culturally Jewish thing. Like, the worse the enemy, the more eventually these rumors raise up, and then you're like, do you know Hitler had a Jewish cousin? You know, there's this strange Jewifying of the enemy in a really strange concept, except for the fact this story, I could give those sort of cultural ideas of how things work. But I'm usually saying, you know, everything is fiction. But of all the stories that I've ever written, mm-hmm, that one is utterly based on a war we had with the local anti-Semite. Exactly what you're saying with about your daughter. Like, it's hard to explain that, like, 20 minutes from Manhattan, you know, not far from, you know, 47th Street and the Diamond District and Brooklyn and all this stuff, that we had a full-on battle with this, you know, anti-Semite in our town. It was just insane. And yes, we all believed that the father was Jewish. This was part of our,
yeah,
belief.
But were you one of the Blums?
No, not in imagining or not in thing. But yeah, that's a very, you know, not to get all serious, but it's a real primal memory for me. I remember of, like, being surrounded by these kids and racing home, and it's this idea of my parents racing out of the house to sort of, yeah, rescue my sister. But that was just part of our life, was getting chased home from school. I'm not fast on a basketball court, but if you chase me with a yarmulke, I can move.
I got jumped by a kid going to Sherman School, Mount Calvary. I always want to say Calvary, but it's Calvary. He jumped me, and there was some, you know, I heard the word Jew. I knew it was just involving it, you know.
You and looked around.
He got me in an arm in the alley there, right on where my aunt Ida, lived right on the alley there. And she saw through the window, and she called my mother, and she said, "They're killing Michael. They're killing." And I wasn't much of a fighter, you know, so I got out of it, but he got the better of it and stuff. But that, right, sort of stuff was always happening. And for no particular, I mean, all my friends were, you know, were Lutheran or whatever, you know, Catholic. But, you know, if someone wanted to get at you, that's what they would say. They'd bring up the Jewish thing and your responsibility for something that you didn't, you know, weren't really responsible for.
Right.
And that was sort of the atmosphere growing up, and it was very odd, you know. Because even a friend would turn on you just to use that, you know, if the situation was useful or something.
Yeah.
Odd, but totally different now. But I love the fact that the kids in this story, they go looking for, like, a golem.
Yes, they find the biggest kid in town to beat, yeah, the anti-Semite for them.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it's actually it's a funny story, but it's also, it resonates.
Yes, the stories are funnier than they describe.
Yeah.
I'm like, it's a Holocaust romp, that story.
Yeah. I know. You know, and that reminds me of this, the other story, the title story, where the couples are talking. One, the Orthodox friends, two women friends who were Orthodox, one ends up marrying and going to Israel. And being more so. And her other friend marries a guy who's Jewish, I guess, but he's pretty Americanized. And she becomes less so. But they meet again after all these years, and they have this kind of a drunken party where they discuss all these issues.
Yes.
And that's very illuminating. Sorry, if people wanted to know sort of about what, you know, the Jewish mindset or something, it really brings it all out there.
Well, I mean, it's a good show to be on this, that with a question mark at the end of your name, but I think there's a reason I write fiction, is I don't have a lot of answers, I have a lot of questions. And for me, one, it's based on Raymond Carver's What We Talk About When We Talk About Love, and I thought, right, in a sense,
yeah,
what if we, it's the title of the book, What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank, if we replace that idea of love or mix it in with ideas of, you know, history and the Holocaust and memory. But, you know, this is back. I did live in Israel for 5 or 6 years. You know, the book just came out in Hebrew yesterday. That's why I'm going for book tour. Oh. But it's that notion there of that sense of knowing and surety. And I guess the story is really about who owns history or who owns memory. You know, this idea of being more religious people. I mean, I think about it a lot. And I think a lot of it's an echo of, you know, this American election year of people claiming true knowing of things for others. And I think it sort of obsessed me in this. I think the book got written in this, you know, in our 4-year election cycle, but I just kept hearing people banging their Bibles and getting on the radio and telling other people how to live with such clarity. And I thought, it's, you know, mm-hmm, who owns what?
Yeah. And one of the things I like about it is that the Holocaust joke, which is a verboten kind of thing, you don't tell,
yes,
them about the numbers on the hand.
Yes. Yeah, well, there's a very dark joke in there, but yeah, I thought, you know, this idea when people try to make things sacred, I think that's a very dangerous thing in the world and in history. You know, this idea of, you know, how genocides get committed, or, you know, this idea of even being beaten from school. When you identify with someone else as human or the same, you don't, you know, That's not who you attack. It's the dehumanizing thing. And I think there's this idea of protecting certain things in history. We don't talk about them. We don't, you know, it was like Bill, you know, you made the wrong comment, like when Bill Maher lost a show post 9/11. I think there's certain ways where people try to protect things that don't actually protect them. And I think if you actually grow up in a world with Holocaust survivors or the kids of survivors, like they say the dark, I remember my friend, you know, I was in high school the first time, like this friend Paul said to his dad, who was an Auschwitz survivor, like, at least you got to go to camp. You know, and I remember like, you know, But this
he's
idea,
entitled
right? But this is they did. This is if you're building a reality, like that's really how people talk. You know, they don't. They're not disrespecting the memory. They're living the memory, and they're living with the repercussions and the murdered relative and the whole idea of history and lost family. The point is that's not disrespectful. That's when you're building a reality. There's always that balance of tension, or you explode. And I think that's how humor forms. So yes, I think not allowing that kind of reference. That's an outsider protecting something from the outside. Yeah. But an insider deals with everything differently. And I don't think, you know, that's why fiction would be flat. I think the funniest things, you know, at least in my world, if someone calls, God forbid, you shouldn't know from it. But if someone calls with an emergency or bad news, they usually make a joke in that. You know, I feel like there's a real balance that the funniest things are kind of dark, at least to me, and the darkest things always have this release valve.
Yeah, and they're living with how they're living with it. That's, yes. That's how you live with it, with trying to put it into some...
Yes, and there's, I mean, I think there's, you know, where the Madison Library could tip over from the PhDs that are written, I'm sure, but like so many psychology, you know, they do, there are just probably stacks of them, people doing their theses on, you know, first generation, you know, what it is to grow up in these homes of survivors, what it is to live with that very strange, you know, pressure on you.
Yeah. And this story, they're in a locker room of a club or something like that, and they're changing.
So the story is this, yes, the son's, the ultra-Orthodox son's visiting his father, and they're in this locker room, and the son notices that the numbers, the guy changing next to him, you know, I say like they're two big beige manatees, and I say, you know, pulling the sock on's the whole workout in itself, basically. But these two old guys, he notices the numbers on their arms are two numbers apart, you know, like that these guys were two people away from line, and he wants this huge moment, exactly my point of these things, of trying to add, import, an ad thing, and he finally gets them to acknowledge a difference in numbers, and the father says, you know, all it shows is this guy's a cutter, you know, like he cuts in line. He cut me there, and he cuts me here, you know, and it's this huge, huge deflation. But you know what? Like, you see these things, and there was a piece in the Times, whatever you write in fiction, it's crazy. Whatever you can dream up, if you put it down, it'll start appearing. Like, I saw a thing in the Times, there was a video of a woman, you know, just months after the book came out, saying how she was somewhere and found someone, you know, people, like, I just then saw a story of, you know, someone bumping into someone with numbers right nearby. And I mean, the best examples from my first book, I had a story about Reb Kringle, about a poor Hasidic man who's big and fat with a white beard who can only support his synagogue by working as Santa Claus. And, you know, I did not know that, you know, I was writing in my room. I didn't know the book was going to have any success, but I have traveled America. I have met more Jewish Santas than you can imagine. They come special. Big, fat, white-bearded Jewish Santas, like, wait for me. Those are my, you know.
Yeah. How does it play in Israel? I mean, I guess you'll find out when you get there.
I get there. Yeah. It's funny. I actually always get nervous. Back to that idea of knowing. You know, I think they like their American Jewish writers in the sort of mold that you were describing as cultural Jews writing about America. Mm-hmm. And a lot of my stuff is... You know, I lived there many years, is concerned with a lot of the concerns about, you know, I have a story about exploration of the settlements. And so I'm always very sensitive before I get there to see the people on the report. Journalists have been nice on the phone, but we'll see. You never know till you get off the plane if they'll be, you know, who's waiting for you on
you
the
have,
end.
You haven't heard on the grapevine or and people.
The journalists have been literally just the reviews will hit soon. So
just the reviewers, not
readers. Yeah. Well, it's one day out, so.
Do you expect it would be sort of a different reaction than American audiences would have to this American?
Yeah, I think I have to say, and this is, I try and be cynical all the time and make jokes about everything, but the sincere thing for me, I feel very fortunate to try. I've been, you know, this year to, you know, I don't know, Italy and Germany and Austria and, you know, Scotland and Wales. I know, the point is traveling around the world with a book, you see the power, like what... Not, I'm not saying in my book, but the idea that a book, when you think of translation, that somebody has taken my whole book and replaced every word with another word, you know, like they've taken out every word that I spent years writing and replaced them with another word in another alphabet in another language, and that someone can have that experience, like that is so universal and human, and it's fascinating to me, and every country is different, and you get this experience. I mean, for me, a huge moment, like two huge moments was when I got to Amsterdam. This book is called, you know, there's not Anne Frank in the book, it's the idea in the title, but for someone in Amsterdam to say to me, like, how do you use the name Anne Frank in your book? Or so, you know, like, to really be faced with that question in front of an audience and need to acknowledge what it means and, you know, what she means to us here versus what she means in that city versus, you know, or in Austria, you know, back to this Holocaust joke, Austrian gentleman in the audience raised his hand and said, you know, I read the section, thank you for referencing it, but I read that scene, and he was like, I don't know if we're ready for a book like this in Austria. And I said, thank you, I don't know if you should be. You know what I'm saying? Like, we're ready in the States. Like, you're literally, it plays differently, and you know, for each individual, but even every nation, and it's really helps me come home and write to understand how a story moves through the world.
Yeah. Just on the Israeli, like, American Jewish front, there's, I'm maybe speaking out of church here, I guess, in saying this, but, there, you know, Israelis oftentimes don't have much...
I'm going to agree with whatever you say.
Yeah, so. they don't really much... care for or even consider them to be actually Jewish American Jews because they are so they're not Orthodox, they're not practicing.
But I love that sort of I don't understand why American Jews have a problem with it. The most famous case, and I was actually in the room with Aleph Bet Yehoshua, a very famous Israeli author who loves he loves to say it before he comes on American Book Tour and had to, I think, cancel one, but say, like, the American Jews are not real Jews. Like, Israel's the future for Jews. And I was at a breakfast for him, and he said it to Elie Wiesel, who is, our Jewish Santa Claus. Like, you know, to stand in front of Elie Wiesel and be like, the American Jews are not Jews. But I think you're allowed to have city pride. You know what I'm saying? I say, like, that's fine. You believe that. And you know what I'm saying? When I'm in Jerusalem, I thought it's the best city. When I'm in New York, it's the best city. Now I'm like, I'm here in Madison. Like, I love this city. I don't mind. I don't think why it's a conflict for people, you know, especially in the challenging existential circumstances that Israel faced, for people to take great pride and believe in what they're doing. So, you know, they can think Israel's the best for Jews. You and I think Madison is clearly the future, the Jewish homeland.
Yeah. And I mean, it's a little bit funny because Catholics don't say, man, if you're not living in the Vatican, you're not really a Catholic. You know, I mean, you should be in Vatican City. You know?
Right. So there's a lot of empty rooms there. They can let more people live there.
And a lot to eat and drink and read. And he's got everything. He's really set up.
Post office.
Set up pretty good there. And then, well, you are actually, speaking of translating, you are translating, I thought this is unusual, or a new translation of the Passover Haggadah.
Yes, that was a crazy...
Which usually was produced by Maxwell House, all the years in our family, you know, on the back.
It's hard to compete. I think the book's been doing well, but it's hard to compete with a book that's prices free. They give that one away.
So do they still?
Maxwell House. Yeah, there's something... I don't know if there's... It's many millions of copies in print. Yeah, they just redid the translation. But, I mean, this collection that we're talking about is really a product of two projects. There's this play that I had open in the fall and the translation. So the writer Jonathan Safran Foer, that I'm sure you've all heard of, Eating Animals and... Everything is illuminated. So the point is, Jonathan is a good friend, and he had a dream about this project, and he was not raised as religious as I was. You know, he was raised in a, I think, conservative, he's raised in a good conservative cultural family, i.e. he's less traumatized. Like, the last thing I'd want to do is spend years on a Jewish cultural project like this. But he really was adamant, and he had this dream for this book to talk me into being the translator, and I'd never translated, never wanted to translate, and, you know, and also I'm a sort of like, it's like people strive to be religious. I'm like an atheist who's working on my atheism. It's always like this failed atheism that I really strive toward. But he talked me.
Well, Jews make the best atheists. That's my dad always said that.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but the point is, I was he talked me into translating this text that's mostly, you know, that's read at Passover at the Seder, and that's where you remember the Exodus. So it's mostly biblical excerpts, and it was, you know, probably it's a few thousand words, but I spent years on it. It was a great responsibility to think that people would be worshiping from this thing that I was translating.
This is, by the way, if you don't know, on Passover, this is the book you go through and say the four questions and why is this night different from all other nights? And you're yelling a song, you got to do the four questions. So that was my deal. Who was the original author of that? Do we know?
God is the one.
Who took the notes on that? Who, the original?
That's funny.
It's good writing, right?
I mean, God and then Moses' secretary. Yeah, it's mostly biblical quotes, and then there. Yeah. I mean, it's for 1,000 years. So yeah, there's some medieval stuff in there. But
someone in the Maxwell family, probably.
Exactly, Stevie Maxwell.
Yeah, from Maxwell House Coffee Brothers. Jewish, the only Jewish coffee that we knew of. My mother owned served Maxwell House. Mom, can we at least get some Folgers or something?
Exactly.
What's with the Maxwell House? And the thing about it that always bothered me doing it were the what they did to the Egyptians in there.
The
plagues. Did you rewrite the plagues at least?
I can't believe
you lighten up on the plagues.
I can't believe you're asking this, but there were a lot of questions about translation. I thought about that a lot. It's unbelievably, there's a lot of violence in there. Yes,
it's horrible.
One does not take vengeance upon people's children, but that is
the
what
firstborn,
God did.
Yes. All right, I'm the lastborn, so it's not really a problem for me, yes. But I felt bad for Clayton.
Yes, I actually, sitting with it, I did really notice that it was a very violent thing. But that's why there's four sets of different people writing different commentaries. In fact, actually, Daniel Hendra, Lemony Snicket is doing commentary on the
plagues. Did he just do the plagues?
Yes, he did. He did a running commentary through it. That's quite beautiful. He's one of the funniest. Yeah, he's a super funny guy.
Yeah, I talked to him one time. He's hilarious. Yeah. Stuff.
Yes, we were doing a signing in California, and the book is called What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank, and anyone who I signed it for, he would then cross out Anne Frank and write Daniel into every copy, which to me was just
going too far.
Yeah, hysterical.
Yeah. And meaning-wise, though, I mean, there like Hebrew words and English words are not necessarily, they don't go like this. They can go whatever because they're in different places, right? I mean, make a lot of changes in terms of the translation?
No, I thought about this a lot because I take everything I do compulsively seriously, but there's every kind of Haggadah in the world. There's vegan, vegetarian Haggadahs. There's God-free Haggadahs for the Jewish atheist who also wants to worship, which is an awesome space. There's an Alcoholics Anonymous Haggadah. There's Armed Forces. There's for every... But I had no agenda except loyalty to the text. I feel like, much like the Constitution,
My name is God.
Yeah, well, just...
The AA.
Yeah, but this idea of like...
My name is God.
But we change society. We don't change the text. Sort of when I heard, at the inauguration, like all men are created, like it's all men and all, we don't remove, I feel like, slavery from the Constitution. This is our shame that we change our society around it. And I feel like it's not my job to change that text, but it made for me.
Well,
challenges.
I mean, were there some naughty translations could actually change the meaning of...
Well, that's the point.
Say a plague was not a plague. It was more of a...
No, but it just sort of freaked me out of the idea of what it is when we think of how much of our world is based on, like in America, how much is based on the English Bible. That's not, if you believe in the Bible, but that's not someone else. Choices were made, like a human being. You can believe it's God's word, but it wasn't God. The Italian version isn't, it's gone through a wash, and that to me, when you think of people living and dying based on word choice, that's why it took me years to think. I say like this idea of really to give the rhythm and meaning and feel of a word. Like if I asked you for another single word for water that has that rhythm and that feel, you'd say liquid. No, that's not it. Like the idea of finding words that don't translate, that have a singular, gigantic meaning. Yeah, it just was a mind bender.
Can you tell me any of those? A word or two in there that you... struggled with?
I just don't want people at home to drive off the road if they fall asleep as I do.
No, that's okay.
God liturgy right now.
Yeah, pull over
right
now.
Have a cup of coffee while I talk about
pull over
I think a big word is Eloheinu, which is God, but it's to me it's translated as our God, and I thought, for hundreds of years, and I used it's translated as our God, and I thought the word is not a two words. It's not our God. It's a singular word, and it's about God. I did it with hyphens, but God of us, which was sort of a radical choice, because I thought this idea of us saying our God is sort of taking ownership of God. To keep repeating that, it loses its meaning, and it's sort of this idea there's enough conflict, but this idea of taking ownership of God, it's not that. What you're saying is you're giving yourself to God, and it's the God over us, and that was
other,
sort of
other way around,
radical in the Haggadah underground choice.
Have you heard about that particular choice?
It's Jews. I hear about everything. Every choice has been raised, I promise.
Well, and the play, I really don't know about the play. I read that it's 27th
Man, yeah.
27th Man. Tell us about that.
Sure. This was, I called the Rip Van Winkle contract, but when my first book came out, I heard from my agent, she said... and I miss her deeply, but that Nora Ephron, when Harry Met Sally, the director and everything, the director and producer and essayist and novelist, the very brilliant Nora Ephron wanted to take me for a lunch, which is a lunch I wanted to take. I was, 12 years old in short pants, but she had read the book just out of nowhere and just had read the book and read this story and saw a play in it and wanted to produce this play only if I would write this play. And I asked for permission to write my novel first. She said, great, that took 10 years. I came back and she was waiting, and she really, to me, it was just this life-changing thing, back to this translation of how all I ever dreamed of was being a writer, but of literary fiction, this very frame thing. And working in these other forms made me see that one can be passionate about other things and what it is, you know, at this age to relearn, you know, just like dialogue. There's a way people talk, and then there's the two of us talking, and I hope this sounds natural, but it's the natural way that we talk, knowing that there's microphones in this wonderful audience. Like, and then when you write a story, it's like dialogue is the way people read, and they're going to hear it in their brain. Well, state, I had to literally, after all these years of writing, relearn how to write, and we would just... I would draft and draft and draft and go to her house and she'd, you know, give me bagels and beat me up and send me home, you know, and we would do this for a year. And then eventually she sent it to the wonderful people at the Public Theater in New York, you know, Hair, Chorus Line, Shakespeare in the Park. So it's, you know, Oscar Eustace, the wonderful director, and now he runs the Old Globe in San Diego, Barry Edelstein, my director, you know, Oscar Eustace's dramaturge and who runs the theater. But they, you know, they just gave me this opportunity, and then they, after Nora was done brutalizing me, they brutalized me endlessly. And you know, 3 years later, we had a play open this fall with a, you know, wonderful cast with Ron Rifkin and
Ron Rifkin,
you know,
is great.
Yeah, Byron Jennings and Chip Zian and
Just a plot summary of The 27th Man is...
Yet another cheery story for me. When I was dreaming of writing, I guess I had heard, this is back to Israel, I did my junior year there, I was 19, and I heard, this is right before the wall came down in Berlin, which is 20 years ago, I guess, a little more, 23. Anyway, but right before the wall came down, I just heard this story this teacher mentioned as a side in a separate class that Stalin... in 1952, he'd rounded up and killed, and you know, he was just killing everybody. He'd like, you'd go over to his house to play pinochle, and then he'd kill your wife, and then he'd kill you, then he'd kill your dog. He was just mad with murder, but he rounded up basically the last of the Yiddish writers and had had them all murdered, and we knew nothing. And I was dreaming of being a writer. I was 19, and I thought, here, these writers have been murdered, and nobody. It was just sort of a rumor that had, like, people knew that at this time. Just the idea of it was getting out to the West, and I thought they've been denied the greatest story of their life. Someone owes them. I thought a real writer should write these people a story, and I waited for years, and nobody was writing them a story. So that was what I consider my first, you know, grown-up adult. I just decided I would try and do it. And the idea is that in this cell with these great men, a young writer who's never been published, never been heard of from a little inn on a mountaintop has been thrown in somehow with all these legends to be executed. And, the real question, which is the question I was asking myself, which is, you know, because you don't know you're going to get to be a writer if you dream of writing, which is if no one ever reads a word, like, are you a writer if you write and nobody ever hears or sees or reads a word? And it's an exploration of that. Simply, is this little boy dying with these legends, like, is it as a writer that he dies?
Ah, fantastic. Nathan Owen, thank you so much for stopping by. I know you're busy and you're getting ready to leave our shores once again.
I'll be back.
Love the writing. It's a great pleasure meeting
Thank
you.
Thank you so much. What a treat.
Nathan Englander, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much. Books, what we talk about when we talk about Anne Frank, short story collection, The Ministry of Special Cases, 27th Man you heard about, which is the drama right now. Performed, and For the Relief of Unbearable Urges. That's a terrific title in and of itself. Nathan Englander. Thank you. All right. Good. Hey.
Hi.
How are you?
Who am I?
How are you?
How are you?
Good.
I'm good. Yeah.
Yeah, you're good. Yeah.
It's good. Oh, I got to apologize about last week at lunch, I like stiffed you guys on the tip. I like...
You stiffed us on.
Yeah, I didn't mean to, but I
know we came up short.
I know we came up short. There's only three of us, and it was my fault. So this week I got the tip.
And Jim's no longer around to be blamed for it. You know, we say, all right, Jim, come on, the extra dollar, put it out.
No, when I was coming out of the parking garage, I was looking at my wallet. Like, I was horrified. Like, oh my God, that was me.
That was you.
Yeah.
Then because you always overtip.
I know.
You are an overly generous tipper.
Well, I try to be, but not last week. So.
Oh well, okay. Well, that straightens out that mystery then. I actually had to cough up $2 extra, but I'm not going to make a big deal about it. I'll get you today.
Okay.
Glad. Thank you for clearing that up.
Yes.
Yes. Now, this number here.
Oh, well, I don't know. I'm going to shorten this.
Okay.
And then you can go in the audience because you got shorted.
I do.
In the first hour, and we'll just play a little short one here, and then you can get going.
All right. Short one.
Ladies and gentlemen, once again, it's Michael Feldman.
Oh, I feel sorry for people at home. They missed nearly a magic moment. It was so close to being a magic moment there. But we'll get back to that. Those of you who are here, what should I take to a gluten-free Super Bowl party? AJ, is that right? AJ, where are you? Okay. Did you find something yet? Okay. Let's see. Has anyone ever gone to a gluten-free Super Bowl party, I guess is the question. I guess I could go down here and get through, right? Pardon me. Pardon me. So sorry. Pardon me. Can I get you stand up here, Ajay? How are you?
Pretty good.
Yeah. Now, who's throwing this gluten-free Super Bowl party?
A friend of my girlfriend's.
Yeah. Kind of counterintuitive, isn't it?
I don't know.
Because she's a football fan, but she's gluten-free.
No, it all works together.
I guess that makes sense. I don't know. I've never been to like gluten-free. It's like a beer-free Super Bowl party. That'd be tough, too. So what are you thinking about making?
We're thinking maybe some dip.
Isn't there gluten in dip? There's got to be gluten in dip. Oh, you put the gluten into the dip, right? Gluten-free chips in a gluten-free dip.
Corn chips.
Corn chips. There you go, in a dip.
I think we're gonna look that up.
Okay, well, good. I'm glad we saw that. I don't know what you can do in lieu of beer, though. That's gonna be a tougher one. Nice to meet you. Gluten-free. Oh, pardon me. How many of you are actually having a Super Bowl party? There's no reason for us to celebrate here. No one here is actually. What's the point? Packers aren't in it. Packers made it possible, but they're not in it. Okay. Where can I buy a dog sled and 4 sled dogs? Karen Brock wants to know. Come on, the weather's not that bad, Karen. It's been bad, excuse me, but not that bad. You don't have to get up, really. Kind of you, though. There she is. I'm getting there. Pardon me. If I step on anything, I apologize in advance. How are you?
I'm fine. It's nice and snowy outside.
Yeah. You on a sled? And have you ever done any mushing?
No, I haven't, but I just want to say our pet ferret died, and we're in the... We're thinking about getting some new pets.
Well, you get a bunch of ferrets to pull your ferret, ferrets to pull your sled. I mean, if you had like 20, 30 ferrets, I would think they could.
Yeah, but I'm thinking if we're going to get some pets, why don't we get dogs or something, get a dog sled, and, you know, go around town that way.
Have you thought about this as well?
Yeah, I'd like to go across the lake to the Arboretum. Might as well do it with ferrets or dogs.
Isn't that sort of over-preparing for crime? I mean, it's not a big lake to begin with. You know, you could...
That's true. It's small, but it'd still be fun.
Okay, well, I'll let you know. Anyone who has a dog sled available or ferret sled, call us in. We'll fix you right up.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, I thought she was serious. She's not. Well, about this one, then. What is the Schwarzschild radius? Stephen Cullen, probably, he's an IT professional, so we suspect it's something IT... Okay, all right, well, I'll have to get over you then. Don't leave. I'll get there eventually. We'll get to the Schwarzschild radius. Until then, I love driving in Wisconsin winter weather. We need to study this person. Who is it? Paula Ray? Paul? Oh, good. You're closer than he is. I'll get to him eventually and find out what that thing is. Can I get you to stand up and just say hello to us all here? Paula Ray, ladies and gentlemen.
Hello.
You know her as Paula. And here she is, Paula Ray. How are you?
Pretty good.
Do you actually like driving in winter weather around here?
Yes, I do.
What, is it a challenge that you like?
Well, it's part of my job.
Oh, it is?
I was thinking about the question, and yeah. When I got this job, my parents would always send me...
What's the job, first of all?
It's on OTR, and they kept sending me job descriptions on over the road truck driver, mm-hmm. And that's not what I do.
What does OTR stand for?
Well, I'm an occupational therapist.
Okay.
But they kept sending me these job descriptions about truck drivers, and I just thought it was funny because this week.
So you're over the road, but you're an occupational therapist.
Yes, okay. And. I spend a lot of time in the car because I do home therapy now, so, yeah.
So you just like the challenge of taking a curve and sliding to the...
Well,
outside.
Well, I get to see people when they're zooming past me in Madison and around, and the hand gestures, and because I drive quite slow. I drive actually the speed limit. And
well, you're that person.
They don't do that. They don't do that.
That's a suggested speed limit.
Yes.
Retail price.
But if you really do sit back and you put on your sunglasses, Madison's beautiful. And
you put on your sunglasses and drive the speed limit. And
going down.
That's the best way in this kind of icy road conditions.
Going down Northport Avenue on Wednesday, there was a whiteout.
Yes.
I was scared.
But you had the time of your life, didn't you? And your sunglasses there with a whiteout, and you're driving 25 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And you got there just fine, right?
Oh, yeah. Going about 20 or 30 miles an hour.
Yeah. Whatever the limit was there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you very much. I think that's inspirational to the rest of us.
Well, thank you.
For out there giving you those hand signals you referred to. All right. Let's see now here. Okay. How does one retire if one has never worked? Glenn Fuller, an artist. Well, you're an artist, Glenn. There you are. You're an artist right over there, aren't you? Are you referring to yourself or to me? Because I thought that of myself, too, that I have to retire at some point, but I've never really worked. So it's an odd feeling, you know. Stand up here. Let's say hello. Glenn Fuller, ladies and gentlemen, Lake Mills. He's an artist. Oh, I'm sorry to make you do that.
Yeah, a little knee problem here.
A little knee problem? What did you do to it?
I went to the doctor to get it fixed.
Yeah. Oh.
And then wake up, they said, it's too bad. We couldn't fix it.
Yeah.
And so it's like, now I got to think in terms of retirement.
Well, you want to get your money back, at least from the doctors.
Yeah.
They give refunds there?
He was too scary. I was afraid to ask him.
Yeah, yeah. What sort of art do you do?
Anything that anyone will pay me for.
What will people pay you for, I guess, is a better question.
Cartoon animals on cereal boxes.
Well, yeah, you do? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
That'd be a good way to make a living, right?
I did a lot of Riley dogs on cereal boxes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was fun. That was fun.
Yeah, cool.
But I've also done, in the old days before photography, every Bushnell binocular and telescope that they had in their catalog, I had to draw.
No kid.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Those were cool because they gave me all the telescopes and stuff.
Yeah.
And when I returned them, I returned every single one without stealing one.
Yeah.
They were so ecstatic. They said, you can pick any one of these to have for yourself.
Now, which Bushnell did you pick?
It was a little tiny one. I like the little tiny binoculars. I still have them. They're great.
Now, if one is asked to draw a Bushnell, what approach does one take in terms of graphically? What would you do? Pen and ink or you?
This was a few years back, so yeah, it was literally pen and ink. It was, technical pens.
Wait a minute. You see, I'm talking to someone. How rude.
But yeah, and what was great, though, was this was pre-computers. And so I'd have like a telescope to draw and then another telescope, and they looked kind of the same. So I'd kind of cut them apart and kind of paste the hard parts. And so then I just kind of touch up, and it's like, oh, aren't I cool? I have two telescopes here that I'm being paid for, and I only drew one.
Yeah.
But now in the computers, it's like, boy.
Now, that was in the days when it was literally cut and paste.
It's literally.
You don't think it's a euphemism now.
It's key line paste up. Yeah. All these key line paste up guys are unemployed now.
Good to meet you, man.
Great.
Good luck with that knee, too, man. I hope you get some help on that. I'm sorry about that. And we can't retire because we don't have retirement skills. However, we're going to play the What Do You Know quiz. And I could do this in the retirement home, I guess, pretty much. We could have, hey, everybody, let's do a little quiz now. And they say, get out of my face. You thought about it. You had a whole quiz to think about it. I know you're out there thinking about it. Look at this guy here. He's dressed for any weather. Do you believe it? Unbelievable. No, I'm not picking you. I'm just pointing out the fact you're still wearing. No, come on. You got the ear flaps and everything.
Yeah.
When do they go down? In the really cold weather?
Yep. When it's really cold.
Yeah.
And the front comes down too.
Yeah. Very nice. Very handsome.
Thank you.
It's a handsome look. And you are?
Dennis Fosen.
Dennis, you from around here?
From La Crosse.
From La Crosse. Oh, we're going to be there not too long. And Dennis.
When?
Oh, I don't know. I'll get you the date. When is that?
The 16th of February.
Says it?
Yeah, I believe so.
In La Crosse?
Oh, no.
No, that's not it, no. Anyway,
sorry,
we'll tell you when we're there. So, What do you do these days?
I'm a cheesemaker.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, now give me one reason you play this quiz, Dennis.
Because I drove here from La Crosse and I want to play.
Okay, he drove all the way from La Crosse. He's a cheesemaker. He's got the hat. How many reasons do I need? Come on up here, Dennis. You okay? Lean on me if you need to. Just don't fall on me. Because then we both go down and it's a mess. Dennis, right?
Yes.
Yeah, did you hail from La Crosse originally, Dennis?
Actually from a small town about 35 miles southeast of there.
Which is?
Lafarge.
Lafarge.
Home of Organic Valley.
Yeah, I've seen Lafarge. Organic Valley is, of course, a wonderful mystical place.
Great.
Mythical, mythological place.
Yes.
Unicorns and organic food and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Pretty much, okay. And have you been a cheesemaker for a while now?
All my life, since I was 15. I just celebrated my 40th year.
In cheese. 40 mm-hmm. years in cheese. That's the title for you.
my autobiography.
Are you what they call an artisan cheesemaker?
No, I'm not.
You're a real honest-to-God cheesemaker.
Industrial type.
Industrial cheesemaker.
Food service, okay. That sort of thing.
Yeah. So who do you have your own company?
No. No.
Who do you work for?
A company in Whitehall.
Yeah.
Whitehall Specialties.
Whitehall Specialties, and their specialty is massive amounts of
food
cheddar.
Service,
yeah.
Individually wrapped slices,
yeah.
Block cheese.
Do you ever go outside the box, cheese box, push the envelope, cheese envelope?
Actually, in my younger days, yeah. I won the Governor's Sweepstakes Award for cheese in a can.
Cheese in a can? You mean like a cheese whiz type
yeah,
thing?
Yeah, but it was very, very good.
Yeah.
Yeah, a state fair winner.
Was that before Cheese Whiz or?
No, after Cheese Whiz.
After Cheese Whiz, yeah. But it was like a real cheese and.
Yep, yep. It was very convenient. Yeah. You know, take it to the beach, shelf stable.
Yeah. You can take a can of cheese to the beach.
You can.
Does that still exist? That product?
Not that product, but Nabisco makes a similar product.
Oh yeah. Yep. Isn't that interesting? Did you able to get a patent on that or?
No.
Did you? A little late to think about that now.
No, Nabisco had the patent on, or had the can technology prior to the company that I worked for at the time.
Oh, yeah, okay, oh, cool. Oh, cool, oh, cool. What do you do for kicks?
Walk my dog.
Yeah, what kind of dog you got?
Mutt. Yorkie, Schnauzer, yeah. And one yeah. other. Maltese.
Well, that's a lot of things. That's like three parents.
Yeah, he's a little guy.
Yeah, cute.
12 pounds.
Cute. All right, Dennis, someone up there plays along with you. You know this quiz works?
Yes, I do.
General knowledge, nothing too tough, generally speaking. Right, Sarah? And how do they do that?
If people want to play the quiz, they pick up the phone and dial 1-800-942-5669.
Okay.
And you ask them a qualifying question.
Okay. Okay. When a Thai texts 5555, he or she is actually saying what? Okay, you're a Thai individual, man or woman. You're texting. In your text, you put 5555. What are you actually saying? This is going to be tough, I guess. Okay, but I'm sure someone in Highland is going to have this. Maybe Zach is the guy who does it. Hey, Zach.
Hey.
You're from Thailand. You're
yeah,
a Thai individual.
Highland, Wisconsin. Yeah.
No, not Highland. Thailand.
Highland, yeah.
Thailand.
Highland.
No. What I'm saying is you're from Highland, but if you were from Thailand.
Oh, I don't know. Huh?
Let me start again. Hey, Zach, you're from Thailand.
Sure.
And you're texting 555. And what does that mean to another Thai individual who receives a text with 555 on it? What is that? It's something, you know, like, what do you think that would mean?
Is it like, let's see, 5555, is it a high five? Like, you know, good job, high five?
No.
Like, all right,
no.
Way to go?
No, I'm afraid that's not it, Zach. Well, let me ask you this.
Sure.
Could it be that a five, that the word for five actually sounds somewhat like another word that we might use in English. Therefore, if you put a 5555, if you were, let's say, Thai American speaker, then you would have said something, 555, such as that word sounds in English.
5555.
Yeah, do you think that's a possibility?
Yeah, it's a possibility, sure.
But
yeah.
Of course, now you'd have to know the word in Thai for five. That would make this something you might say in a text.
Wow.
Yeah, so I guess we're back where we started. Yeah.
It's high.
We're back in Highland instead of Thailand, I'm afraid.
Yeah. Highland?
Yeah.
Almighty. Can you give me a hint at least?
Well, for an American might say LOL, for example.
Oh, laugh out loud? Is that what it is?
No, I'm not saying that's what it is. But.
Oh, like LOL, like...
Yeah. So the word in Thai for five might be something like we might say that would indicate a laugh of or something.
Ha, 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 ha.
That's it. You got it, Zach. Unbelievable. We worked this through. I am so glad for you because Thailand, the connection was just too good to pass up. Zach, this is Dennis.
Hi, Zach.
Hey, Dennis.
You two are a team right now, and you're going to work on this together. Okay, Zach?
We're going to rock it.
You're going to rock it. Okay, I can tell you're going to. What the categories do we have?
The Sarah? Categories are current events, people, places, things you should have learned in school, had you been paying attention, science, and odds and ends.
Okay, Zach, you pick the first one.
Current events.
Current events, right out of the news. The second longest reigning queen in Europe is abdicating in favor of her son. And who would that be?
Queen Beatrix of Netherlands.
Yeah, the Queen of the Netherlands.
Queen Beatrix.
Yeah, Queen Beatrix.
All right,
absolutely.
Queen, yes, exactly right. Queen Beatrix. 33 years is enough, I guess. That's long enough, and so that would be
one right and zero wrong.
Okay, good.
And the categories remaining are people, places, things you should have learned in school, science, or odds and ends.
Okay, Dennis.
Try science.
Are you a Beatrix fan? You knew that right off the bat.
Actually, I heard it on public radio earlier in the week.
Aren't we good?
On my way to work.
Okay, the Sapiens and the Neanderthals. In terms of their dating, let's say. Okay. Did they never ever date? Did they date some, but it never worked out good? Or did they date hither and yon? So we're talking about inner
species? Or
you know. I don't have to telegraph this.
Yeah, I'm thinking that they didn't date.
Never ever?
Never ever.
He says never ever.
What are my choices again?
They never ever dated. They dated some, but it didn't work out good. Or they dated hither and yon, just all over the place.
Hither and yon.
He says hither and yon. You got to come with one answer here, gentlemen.
What do you think, Zach?
Let's go with Dennis.
Hither and yon.
I'm sorry. They dated some, but it...
Never worked out?
Yeah, no, never worked out. But there was some, but not a lot. Okay, so that would be...
That's one right and one wrong.
Okay, don't worry about it. You'll get another chance to get this. And what?
People, places, things you should have learned in school, or odds and ends.
Zach?
Odds and ends.
Odds and ends. Let's just see here. Okay. How many times more likely are you to cough during a classical concert than you are in life?
How many times? Four times more.
Wait a minute. I'm going to give you a choice.
Oh, you're
going to
give that answer yet. Okay.
Yeah.
It's multiple choice. I got it.
Yeah. Twice, three times, or four times more. Yeah, in life, during a classical concert than in life in general.
Well, I'm gonna stick with four.
That was your gut reaction. I'm going with it.
Yeah,
four times. You're right. You're four times
well
likelier. No one ever coughs at my show. I noticed that. Except for John and Sarah. Yeah.
That's two right and one wrong.
Okay, close to something here. What's left?
People, places, things you should have learned in school.
Dennis, what are you thinking?
Things you should have learned in school.
Okay, things you should have learned in school. Extinction of species. Not so bad after all? In other words, are there not as many extinctions as you might think?
No answers? No.
It's school. You should have learned this in school.
Okay.
Extinction,
yeah, okay.
Not so bad after all?
You know, I just heard something on public radio about polar bears not being nearly
as extinct,
as they once were. So I'm going to say not as extinct as we thought.
So you're saying no.
Sure.
Because polar bears aren't extinct as they once were. Okay. You're saying no?
No.
Yeah, no. According to some scientists, anyhow, Professor Nigel Stork in the UK, which is good for you. You win.
Hey.
Zach, you can enjoy the insect world without all the buzzing and biting, wearing a delightful Yipes bug pin fashioned by polymer, or rather from polymer clay, from Green Bay's Joyce Fritz studio. Dennis, you'll outwit Wikipedia with What Do You Know? Test your knowledge with the ultimate collection of amazing trivia, quizzes, stories, fun facts, and everything else you never knew you wanted to know by Michael Feldman from Bristol Park Books. And both of you can clean up real good with a bar of What Do You Smell soap, combining the Wisconsin scents of clover, pink clay, and cheddar from Mississippi's Screaming Porch Gift Company, and then play What Do You Know the Party game, including the faultless Michael Feldman bobblehead from Out of the Box Publishing, available exclusively at notmuch.com. Congratulations to you both.
Thank you.
Dennis, thanks a lot. Nice to meet you. Good luck to you and all you do and your dog. Zach, hang out. Make sure you get that. Thanks for playing.
Michael Feldman's What Do You Know is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio for Public Radio International. Michael Feldman, producer international. Adam Friedrichs, our producer, with assistance from Lyle Anderson, Martin Babcock, and Diana Cook. Technical director Tom Blaine, with help from Aubrey Ruff and Brad Colbert.
Bye, y'all. Thanks for coming. Thanks for joining us. Join us again next week.
PRI, Public Radio International.